Hailing Frequencies Open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and in the way of men and women, the pleasure is in the learning of each other. And if that fails, there's always Netflix. I'm joined on this episode once again by Greg Cox. Greg is the New York Times bestselling author of numerous Star Trek novels, as well as many other works of tie-in fiction. His most recent novel, A Contest of Principles, features an all-new Star Trek story set in the TOS era and is available wherever you get your books. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Permission to come aboard granted. Today we'll be talking about For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, the eighth episode of the third season of Star Trek, the original series. The world of Star Trek, the original series, is one of immense creativity, featuring alternate universes, doomsday machines, godlike aliens, wicked adversaries, and Spock's brain. One week, Kirk could be wrestling with a Shakespearean dilemma, the next he's wrestling with the Greek god Apollo, or he's drop-kicking Doc Holliday. TOS as a series excelled in taking common conflicts, wars, political disputes, personal ones, and giving them a sci-fi twist so that they were both relatable and yet engrossing on a new fantastic level. Sometimes, however, that wealth of ideas threatened to overwhelm the basic execution of a four-act primetime drama, and new captivating facets of our familiar characters and the civilizations that they discover would be left unexplored. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Greg, it's great to have you back on board the show. It's been a while. You were on the ninth episode of the very first season of this show back in 2016 to talk about Assignment Earth. And you have not been idle in that time, producing a series of Librarians novels, a Batman novel, and several new TOS novels as well.
This is a good thing. I have been keeping busy, which is a good problem to have. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good problem to have a lot of work. Yeah. And you've been a consistent producer of TOS novels for Simon & Schuster, along with authors like Dayton Ward and Chris Bennett in the last few years. And with the recent sale of SNS to Penguin Random House, can we expect a continuation of your work on TOS books?
Like I said, I just had a new book come out in November. I'm not at liberty discussing future stuff at this moment, but
sure.
I have been writing Star Trek for 25 years now. I did math the other day and was a little stunned to realize I've been writing Star Trek novels for a quarter of a century now. So
yeah,
I would certainly hope to keep doing so, you know.
Yeah, but you've been writing for 25 years and for a lot of different publishers. I remember when Penguin and Random House merged in 2012, there was a lot of concern in publishing about the big six becoming the big five. And now that the big five is becoming the big four, how do you see that affecting the industry going forward?
Well, it's hard, you know, I'll be honest, a lot of these decisions get made well above my pay grade. I'm a consulting editor and have been for many years for Tor Books, which is a leading science fiction and fantasy publisher, but yeah, Tor Books, you know, belongs to Macmillan, which belongs to Holzbrink, a big German consortium. And I can say that honestly, in all the years I worked at Tor, and I'm still a consulting editor, and I used to work there 9 to 5, I never had any dealings with the Germans, you know.
Yeah, right. Sure.
I barely had any, the high execs would go off in meetings. I worked there for, you know, it's probably 1990 on, and I can honestly say I have never spoken with any personally of anybody at Holzbrink.
Yeah.
And, you know, to a certain degree, I mean, I've been to corporate mergers before. I started out as an editorial assistant at Arbor House, a small mainstream publisher. We got gobbled up by William Morrow, which for a while there we existed as a separate imprint, and then we kind of got absorbed into, you know, Arbor House / William Morrow. And honestly, I think at this point, I don't think Arbor House exists anymore. I think we just kind of got, I was gone by then and moved over to Tor. But, you know, there's a level at which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, this stuff happens. Hey, you know, Marvel gets bought by DC. Now DC makes all the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
But on the sort of just, you know, I am honestly kind of taking a wait and see attitude. People ask me, how is this going to affect, you know, again, Pocket Books at this point has had the license for Star Trek since, you know, 1980 something.
Yeah.
You know, the day may come when it moves to another publisher, or it may not. But honestly, I've been hearing rumors and, oh my God, what, you know. So, you know, again, no, and again, it should be noted that I'm a freelancer. I'm sitting here in Pennsylvania. I have not actually set foot in the pocketbook offices, even before the pandemic, for probably, 16 years at this point. They call me up, hey, Greg, we need a TOS book for July. What you got? What high level plans for the franchise? And I emphasize this only to stress that people sometimes assume I have lots of inside information on what's going on with Discovery or what Pocketbook's plans are. Will there be Lower Decks novels?
Right.
I'm a freelance writer who, is not attending the big marketing meetings, let alone the high level corporate merger negotiation stuff. Like I said, in all the years I worked at Tor as an editor and I have written books for Tor, I've never met any of the Germans.
Right. Yeah.
Even though, Holtzbrink owns Macmillan, which owns Tor, that's above my pay grade. So.
It seems so. It's funny because, with your 25 years of doing this, I mean, that's probably four times as long as any executive that would be in charge of making decisions about your work at this point. It seems so strange that, Viacom CBS, recently with the sale of SNS made it pretty clear that they had, real no interest in being involved in the publishing side of the business. And I think that's really weird is I suppose it makes business sense as a rights holder. It just seems like that you'd want to have control of the publishing side of all these properties that, of course, the Germans and everyone else is in charge of. But I guess it's just the nature of the business, this kind of consolidation.
Well, it depends. I've worked for a lot of franchises, and there are varying degrees of oversight.
Yeah.
Now, in fact, it should be noted that everything I write gets approved by CBS. There are people, over in the rights department. I start out, for those who don't already know this, a Star Trek book tends to begin with me writing a 15-page outline. I send it to Pocketbooks. They send it to CBS. They bounce it back to me. Do this, don't do this. We work it all out. I write the book. I send the manuscript over to Pocketbooks. They edit it. They send it to CBS for one last look. CBS comes back. We like this. Change this, don't do this. Mm. And so, it's not like, we're free and clear here. I've worked for, lots of different franchises. Some get more hands-on than others. There's also the fact of TOS, I write mostly TOS's books. The show was canceled in 1969, It's not like, no, you're going to mess up season four.
Right, yeah.
I will say in general with tie-ins, this I could do a whole long, I can and have done entire panels on Zen and tie-in writing. Generally, you tend to get more hands-on supervision when you've got a thing that's still a going concern,
Sure.
If you were writing Alias novels while Alias is on the air.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're going to keep an eye on what you're doing, especially also if a show is more serialized as opposed to something episodic,
Yeah.
I remember there was a world of difference just very briefly when I was working on the 4400 books, which we all remember the TV show, the 4400. I remember the first book I wrote was while the show was still on the air. And we went back and forth, probably did like six different drafts of the outline because we were trying to having to fit the book into the complicated serialized storylines of the show. Mm-hmm. By the time I wrote the second book, the show had been canceled, at which point it was like, basically, he was go fine, Greg. Go ahead, do whatever you want. Where I think that outline was approved in something like a half an hour.
Right.
At that point, like I said, it was no longer a going concern. Now I was not going to mess up any of their future plot lines. It was just, there's one more book on the contract. Go ahead, write it.
Right. Whereas in the meantime, if you're writing Batman, they're like, no, you can't have Batman eat a hot dog. Batman eats tacos.
Sometimes you hear funny stories. I still remember, and this goes back many, many years ago, I should probably mention, at the point we're talking many, many different administrations of DC Comics. I still remember getting a note back to the effect of, Catwoman can't fly a helicopter. Okay, beats me,
Sure.
Your characters, you say so,
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's still canon, by the way, because they've rebooted the universe many times.
Oh, yeah, then. Several times.
Different. So at this point, for all I know, Catwoman can fly a helicopter. But
right.
Like I said, we talk about this. It's an interactive process. I remember I got a note once from Star Trek saying, you can't drink coffee in the transporter room.
They've got a slot, okay. though. They've got a food slot. That? We've seen it.
You know, and to their credit, the note from somebody at CBS, I can't remember who it was, yeah, we remember the chicken sandwich and tomorrow's yesterday. In general, no. I think I had Janeway drinking coffee in a Voyager novel. It was like, no coffee in the transporter room. I said, okay. And this is not something I'm going to go to the mats about.
Yeah, okay. Right.
You know, this is not like, no, you've tossed my entire book. You know,
it all rests on that cup of coffee.
Yeah, I'm going to. Okay, fine. You know, it's sort of like that's your input on the book.
Sure. Good enough.
You choose your battles. The coffee in the transporter room is not something I'm going to fight. You know? Sure. What the hell? Okay, fine. You know, and nobody has ever criticized that book because Janeway was not drinking coffee in the transporter room.
Right. You know? Yeah. That was a losable fight.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of, like I said, you know, the oversight you can get, you know.
Yeah. But. You know, the episode that we're talking about today is a classic TOS episode, and we've seen recent Trek series go back to the 23rd century to tell new stories about a familiar century, if in a new way, with new visuals. And we've got Strange New Worlds on the horizon, featuring Captain Pike, and a kind of a promised aesthetic that will be more like traditional TOS storytelling. As an author of over a dozen TOS or TOS-related novels, what do you think makes a TOS story, other than featuring Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, of course?
Oh, good question. Like I said, I do think that, and this applies to the novels, mm-hmm. that the TOS novels have traditionally been more episodic, you know, than, you know, even, you know, the later shows. And even if you look at the novels, the 24th century stuff tends to be kind of interconnected and such. Whereas, you know, most of my TOS novels are just standalone episodes that, you know, there's not a lot of continuing plot lines. I even try to avoid referring to my own novels too much.
Okay.
Unless it's a designated trilogy. The idea being you can just pick up a Star Trek novel, a TOS novel, and oh, it's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. It's the 5-year mission.
Yeah.
Cool. You know.
Yeah.
And if I refer to anything, I will refer to other TOS episodes. Although these days, as you mentioned, it's cool. We are learning more stuff about the, you know, pre-Kirk era.
Right, right.
Which means all new alien races and stuff. And so, yeah, I love dropping references to Discovery, you know, continuity. I have a list of alien races that we know of in Kirk's time as opposed to, you know, Picard's time. And, oh, I keep adding to that list now because, I can mention Kelpians now.
Yeah, Kelpian crew member, maybe, yeah.
And, oh, they have... there's always a bit of a challenge writing TOS that you're writing a 1966 vision of the future and you want to not make it sound like too retro, but also trying to encompass. But yeah, I'm writing little bits of, you know, technology creep in. Oh, they had cybernetic people. Oh, well, okay. I can do something with that. I'm not going to go nuts. And, you know, but, oh, you had people that had like, you know, Arium on Discovery. Okay, well, I can work a character like that in one of my books now and say that, oh, look, they had this technology in the 24th century, you know, or 23rd century, you know. I can drop reference to, oh, so-and-so is a veteran of the, you know, the old Klingon War.
Yeah, yeah. That's a question that I've always had, and you're probably the person to ask, about the original series and then also just the other series that were sort of built on the foundation of TOS. We never really see cybernetics or any kind of implants or limb replacements or anything like that. And as somebody who's just written in that world, like, why do you think that is? Was it just not on the radar of 60s creators?
It's worth remembering that, you know, 1966 or so was... you know, at this point, 50 or so years ago.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. I mean, you watch Conscience and the King and you wonder, they're trying to identify, you know, is he really, you know, Anton Caridian? And they do talk about voice prints. No one ever thinks to check his DNA. But yes, that's,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, right.
In fact, if you even look at Space Seed, everybody commonly refers to Khan being genetically engineered.
Yeah.
That is what we would now call a retcon. Khan was not mentioned... was not described as being genetically engineered until Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
before that, yeah, the dialogue in Space Seed is all about selective breeding.
Yeah, breeding. And yeah, weird. Yeah.
It's sort of become a retcon that, oh, he was a genetically engineered Superman. And fine, we go for, you know, because as far as that's Wrath of Khan, and then it has been sort of retconned backwards to apply to Space Seed. So, yeah, I was actually doing some research on our designated episode. And yeah, For the World is Hollow aired on November 8th, 1968.
That's right.
Which is, you know, a long time ago. So yeah, there's stuff that, like, you know, and yeah, I will say writing TOS, there's a challenge of trying to sort of write it for modern readers who, you know, also are trying to not going nuts, but keeping the feel of the original series.
Right, yeah.
I will say one of my rule of thumbs is if we can do it now, we can do it in Kirk's time, you know.
Sure, yeah.
You know, we don't see Kirk texting people, but if we can do it now, we can do it in Kirk's time. We assume time did not go, except for seatbelts, we assume time did not go backwards.
No seatbelts.
You know? And CPR. One of the things, oddly, since we're going to be talking about Dr. McCoy, since this episode is a very Dr. McCoy intensive episode, a very Dr. McCoy centric episode, and indeed, I shamelessly mentioned my new novel is a very Dr. McCoy centric novel. One of the things that hasn't aged terribly well is, boy, you know, McCoy gives up on people pretty damn fast.
Yes.
I mean, nowadays you watch, you know, Grey's Anatomy and they'll work for 25 minutes to try to bring somebody back, CPR and that, you know.
Yeah.
Now he's like, he's dead, Jimmy. You know?
Right, yeah.
Dead he didn't dead. Even try.
Right. You know,
guy, red shirt gets zapped, falls over. Oh, you said, Jim, you didn't even. You know, in, you know, modern days, we're used to the, you know, your average EMT working for 25 minutes to try to speak somebody back.
Right. Hold a pocket mirror up to his nose or something, you know.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we you know. I rationalize this on the grounds tricarders are so good that they can actually tell you whether they're. Whether there's any chance.
Of, yeah, he's, you know, absolutely dead. Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
Not mostly dead.
Oh, you know, is it, would CPR work here? Nope. Transporter says no. Okay.
Right, the light is off.
Tricorder says no. So.
Well,
not going to bother, you know.
They were working off a 60s-based idea of science, but TOS was still a very inventive show. And, it really mirrored in a lot of ways the unchecked creativity of the sci-fi literature of the 60s. And of course, many sci-fi authors in the 60s contributed to the show. But sometimes the creative ideas, they really piled up. Like in this episode alone, you've got, of course, the spacefaring humans of the Federation, a generation ship hidden in an asteroid, an oppressed fanatical society run by a broken computer, a guy with a terminal space disease, a love story between two different species. You know, it's like you asked a computer to create a Star Trek episode that embodied all of Trek. And yet Trek would do that all the time, like jam three or four different hooks into one episode.
Yeah, Requiem Methuselah is another one about sidetracking this. It just piles on, oh, there's an immortal guy and an android woman and a space disease. And, you know.
And he's Da Vinci. And yeah, right. Yeah.
And let there be, you know, your last battlefield. You've got the racial allegory going on, and they've got psychic powers, and they're 10,000 years old.
And their ships are invisible, and
Yeah,
this episode gets compared a lot to...
There's a certain sense of throwing things at the wall here, okay.
Yeah, let's just see what sticks. This gets compared a lot to The Paradise Syndrome, which aired just 5 weeks before. And you've got a lot going on in that one. You've also got an asteroid colliding with a planet. You've got the captain assimilating into an alien society, and the aliens are Earthlings abducted by godlike aliens. And the second in command is struggling with his command decisions and obelisks. Any TV exec today would tell you, pick two of those things, maybe suggest a third as a runner that we can just follow through the rest of the season. But everything else has to go. It's way too many hats.
Now, granted, some of them tie together. The whole I watched the episode last night just to refresh my memory, and you kind of need the terminal disease plot line to make the love story work, because otherwise, you know, McCoy is not going to just ditch the Enterprise and his career and his duty in Starfleet to marry a woman he met 15 minutes ago, unless he's like, "What the hell? I'm on the edge of death anyway." Yeah. Kirk has actually put in a request for his replacement already.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, fine. Spend my, you know, he's treating Yonata as a hospice here, you know.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. That's true.
Spend my last year with, the sexy priestess on the hospice planet.
Yeah, right. He does get hit in the head pretty hard too in that fight.
But you know, like I said, I'm not sure. Like I said, the love story happens, as often happens, at sort of, you know, warp speed.
Yeah.
If there's a stretch, it's that Yanada takes one look at, you know, McCoy is like, bang, let's get married, you know.
Right. Yeah. I got nothing going on.
He's his first cup of tea, you know. But
yeah.
But you know, that McCoy would be open to this makes sense in the context of him, you know, looking down the barrel of a gun, as it were, you know.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, like, McCoy doesn't get a lot of material generally, but I guess they have to pack it in when he does. Have you ever written a love story for McCoy?
No, I have not. In fact, if you'll allow me to talk about my book for a second,
sure.
One of the emphases for the new book, A Contest of Principles, was the realization that even though I've been writing Trek books for 25 years, I'd actually never written a McCoy-centric book. That, you know, McCoy's in my books, of course. He's there on the bridge. He's, you know, he's bantering with, bickering with Spock, and he's providing counsel to Kirk.
Yeah.
But I'd never actually written a McCoy, even though I love McCoy, McCoy's a great character, I haven't actually written a McCoy-centric plot. So one of my goals for that book was I'm going to write a McCoy novel. I described the book as my love letter to McCoy. Although oddly enough, for whatever reason, I can't remember why, I didn't give him a love interest in the book, you know. There's a whole medical mystery plot line. He bonds with a patient. He befriends the people on this planet. But I didn't go with a love story.
Sure. Well, he gets one in this, the TOS episode For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. As you mentioned, it first aired on November 8th of 1968. It was written by Rick Volertz. And Volertz was a very prolific television writer in the 50s and 60s, writing scripts for shows like Leave It to Beaver, Wagon Train, M-Squad, Batman, Bonanza, and many more. And he seemed like a real half-typewriter, will-travel kind of writer. You know, he wrote comedy, sci-fi, western, and horror scripts for shows all over the dial. He was an acquaintance of Gene Roddenberry's from their time working on the series Mr. District Attorney in the 50s, and Gene initially contacted him as a potential story editor for Trek's third season after the departure of DC Fontana at the end of season 2. But that job would go to Arthur Singer, but he did pitch story ideas, including this one, to the show. The show was directed by Tony Leader. Leader was also prolific in the 60s and 70s on TV, directing for shows like Sea Hunt, The Twilight Zone, Rawhide, Lost in Space, and Gilligan's Island. He was also a production manager on the National Velvet series, and this is his only Trek credit. The start date for this episode is 5476.3, and your assignment, Greg, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of For the World is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky. And it has to be shorter than the actual title of the episode.
Well, that gives me a bit more elbow room than many other shows. But, okay, I didn't know there was going to be a pop quiz. No, short version, they find this planet, this asteroid that is, in fact, a spaceship. The people on board who have been traveling through space for 10,000 years do not realize that they are on a spaceship. They are being governed by an all-powerful oracle computer god who, as is often the case in Star Trek, an ancient computer whose technology they have long since forgotten. As it happens, McCoy is in fact dying of a terminal disease. He hits it off with the high priestess, Natira. And that's cool. But the problem, of course, is that the Oracle does not like strangers. The Oracle does not want the people of Yanada to find out that they are actually on a spaceship. And, oh, I forgot, due to a problem, the asteroid spaceship is on a collision course with an inhabited planet. So there's a bit of a problem. They need to get the ship back on course. You know, Kirk and Spock are kind of focused on trying to, oh, we need to figure out what's going on here. And I'm way beyond the title now already. we need to actually keep Yanada from smashing into another planet, despite the opposition of the evil computer god who is all fire and brimstone and outsiders must perish, you know, et cetera, you know. And poor McCoy ends up, you know, sort of torn between his new love interest and, oh, I gotta, you know, stop, you know, help Kirk and Spock stop this spaceship from smashing into this planet.
Right. And I'm dying of it.
In the end, turns out the ancient computer has the cure for the disease.
Right.
So McCoy gets to go back to The Enterprise, Yanata's are back on course. And there's a hint that he's going to hook up with Neytiri again when the ship finally meets its destination, but that would be left for the novels to handle. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's a pretty complete synopsis. And you know, it's interesting that it isn't until the novels that, like, they could have done it in the animated series. They could have, like, visited Neytiri or done something with that. But it's just kind of McCoy gets married and it's just kind of left to drift that story thread.
Yeah, I guess it's just sort of like, you know, from his point of view, it doesn't, you know, oh, well, he agreed to marry the woman he met 5 minutes ago because what the hell, he was dying anyway.
Yeah.
We assume his priorities.
Maybe he's a little relieved. It's like, whoa, that was a wild weekend. Yeah.
It is an interesting, there is an interesting moment in the episode in terms of our main crew where, in fact, Kirk agrees with McCoy's reasoning. He balks at the idea of McCoy staying behind. But
yeah, yeah.
When McCoy points out, hey, I'm going to die, let me spend my last years, you know, in domestic bliss with the beautiful priestess, Kirk's like, okay, Scotty, two to beam up, you know.
Right, yeah. And it's also a little bit of, McCoy kind of gets the job that Kirk usually has, which is, okay, I've got to seduce this alien woman, you know, as a stratagem to sort of get us out of here or find more information. McCoy kind of gets to do that in this episode because Kirk and Spock get to go wander the complex while he's keeping everybody busy.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's Kirk's, no surprise, that's Kirk's idea.
Yeah. Why don't you hang out here?
Kirk kind of picks up on the fact that Neytiri, the high priestess, you know, is kind of, you know, eyeing McCoy. He decides to take advantage of this and, hey, McCoy, you can keep the priestess busy.
Right.
We're going to go snoop around, you know.
Here's some money. Go on a date. Yeah.
I don't think McCoy was like, you know, Kirk's probably thinking, Jesus Christ, McCoy, you know, Bones, you're not supposed to agree to marry her, you know. Yeah,
right. You don't marry
her. You don't know how this works. You know, you seduce the priestess. We go snoop around. Wait, you're getting married. You're staying with her, you know. But
right. Well, you stay
that's
here.
That's not how this plan works.
Yeah.
You know?
I'll go find a computer to blow up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's some interesting facts from this, from our memory banks about this episode. And you can feel free to jump in at any point with anything you'd like to add. This is the only TOS episode to feature three actors who were in the cage. Leonard Nimoy was obviously Spock in the cage. Majel Barrett appeared as number one. And John Lormer, who plays the old man in this episode, appeared in the cage as Haskins, or at least the illusory version of Dr. Haskins. And interestingly, Lormer also appeared in the first season episode, The Return of the Archons, as Tomorrow. And that's another episode with a society being run by a computer.
For the World as a Whole, it's a fun episode. I think of it as, to be honest, a sort of mid-list episode.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, at this point, the society run by the insane computer god was a well-established, you know,
yeah,
Trek thing by now.
Yeah.
As pointed out, they'd done it in Paradise Syndrome just a few weeks before that. And then you also have Spock's brain. I'm sure, you know, Return of the Archons, you know.
Sure.
The apple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And stretching a point that which survives. Okay. You know, which is another ancient computer still running long after the demise.
Right. Just all the people are dead. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In that case, it's, you know.
Well, speaking of the old man, I didn't double check on this, but apparently when the old man appears, the music that plays is the same Alexander Courage arrangement that plays during his scene in the cage. And I also like, speaking of music, that whenever the old man is getting a little buzz from his instrument of obedience, there's a little music sting that goes along with that. I love how those old shows would sort of incorporate the playback, the soundtrack into the narrative, into the storytelling of the show.
One thing I noticed last night, it was interesting, I don't think I've ever noticed before, is that as opposed to a lot of episodes where, you know, the landing party is in danger, we don't see the Enterprise. There's actually no cutaways to Scotty fretting because we haven't heard from the captain for 25 hours.
Right.
It's once they get to Yanata, it's all on Yanata. They don't keep cutting back to, you know, well, Captain, you know, Mr. Scott, what do you think has happened to the captain? You know, actually, it's not entirely wrong. At one point, actually, I forgot Kirk and Spock do go back to the Enterprise briefly and then make a return trip to go help McCoy. You know?
Yeah, which is a weird, it's interesting story beat because they specifically mentioned like we're making the unprecedented move of, you know, contacting headquarters basically to go like, what do we do in this situation? And it's not something that really needed to be in the show. So I'm wondering if they wanted to give McCoy a little time with Nitira.
I guess just for the purpose of the plot, you need to kind of give the McCoy Nitira love story time to sort of blossom a bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get the whole bit where McCoy finds out the information and he has to, you know, he's torn between, do I, you know, hey, Captain, you better get back here, you know, even though I'm going to betray my wife. Okay, you know.
Right, yeah, because, yeah, that's what I do.
But to be in McCoy's defense, he's betraying his wife so that her planet will not crash into another planet.
Yeah, right, she will die too, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, you could rationalize that a bit, you know.
Speaking of asteroids crashing into planets, we mentioned the Paradise Syndrome before, and unsurprisingly, for the budget-constrained third season, the effects used to portray the asteroid in the Paradise Syndrome are recycled to depict Yonada in this episode. That's not true of the remastered effects, however. The remastered episodes, which you can see in the current, should be the current streaming versions of the episodes, the asteroids are depicted differently.
The opening scene where they... we forgot the fact that the Enterprise comes under attack by nuclear missiles.
Yes, right.
in the pre-credit trailer, I think, you know, the missiles look to me, I assume, I haven't watched the original version in some time. We're obviously new, and I wouldn't be surprised if the old version didn't even show the missiles. It may be just, you know, I think in some cases in the remastered stuff, they're actually showing stuff that in the old days, oh, all we could do was really kind of talk about.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was like, oh, look, there's the nuclear missiles. I'm not sure, I can't remember, honestly, if we actually saw the nuclear missiles or if we just got dialogue. Captain, I'm detecting, you know, sensors detect missiles charging towards us, you know.
Yeah, it's a weird little thing in the script. I mean, and presumably they lead, you know, the missiles trail leads them back to Yonada, but they're never attacked by any other type of weapon, or there's no effort to sort of deactivate the missile so nobody else comes under threat by them. It's just a little scene at the beginning and it's never mentioned again.
It to provide a bit of jeopardy at the very beginning of the episode,
yeah,
and to give them a sort of an excuse to, you know, oh, let's find out where those missiles came from.
Yeah. Yeah, I always like too when Trek does this, they kind of thumb their nose at like the nuclear age or just like the maybe the Cold War nuclear arms race, because they're like nuclear missiles. They'll run into some alien species that has, oh, they've got nukes. Wow, that's old.
They actually do that at least twice in this episode, because later on when they arrive at Yonada, you know, or something, you know, old-fashioned atomic engines, Captain.
Right.
Very primitive, you know.
They're giving off radiation, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're leaving radiation trails behind.
Yeah.
I guess that also is to go along with the idea that, you know, the generation ship has been in flight for 10,000 years.
Sure, it's old technology, you know. Yes, yes.
Boy, they would have gotten there much faster if they'd had warp drive, you know.
Yeah, that's the problem. You catch up with the generation ship. This episode has the longest title of any episode in any Star Trek series, but it's given a run for its money by Discovery's The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry and DS9's Looking for Parmok in All the Wrong Places. And I love those old full-sentence titles.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, the classic, you know, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, or Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok Man.
I will show my inner curmudgeon, or show my... Yeah, I love the old florid titles much more than, say, the 90s era, where you got titles like Unification, Desecration.
Yeah, or just Article Noun. Yeah, yeah.
you know, which honestly, I find also maybe just, I know the original 79 episodes are burned into my brain from them being syndicated over and over again through my entire childhood.
Yeah.
I have a little trouble remembering, okay, which one was Vectors? I actually made that up. I have no idea if there's a TNG episode called Vectors.
No, there is Patterns of Force, though.
Vectors, whereas... Oh, you know, The City on the Edge of Forever. Okay, I remember that one, you know.
Right, right. There's a lot of syndromes, and there's a lot of, you know, article, adjective, nouns, like the ultimate computer, the doomsday machine.
I will admit that, you know, they aren't all great. I occasionally, which one was Return to Tomorrow again? You know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of, especially since it's not a time travel episode, you know.
Yeah.
And occasionally I have to stop and think, okay, there's this side of paradise and there's the paradise syndrome.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
And there's all our yesterdays and yesterday is tomorrow, you know.
It makes you...
It, I think it is if all our yesterdays are tomorrow. Okay, yeah,
yeah. You have to really give
it
to...
I should write a book called All Our Yesterdays Are Tomorrow. Okay, yeah.
Let's talk about the guest stars in this episode. Catherine Woodville appears as Natira, and Woodville was an English actress who appeared in films and television series throughout the 60s and 70s. She was married to Patrick McNee in the 60s, a star of the 60s series The Avengers, and she appeared as Peggy in the first episode of the series, Hot Snow. And when Peggy is murdered by drug smugglers, her fiancé, Dr. David Keel, joins with the mysterious John Steed to become The Avengers. So she is the character that the Avengers are avenging.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And John Lorimer appears as the old man. Lorimer had a long career in Hollywood, getting his start in a 1950 episode of The Ford Theater Hour, and he ended his career with an appearance in the 1987 film Beyond the Next Mountain. Along the way, he amassed over 170 credits in film and TV, and he appeared on shows like The Twilight Zone, The Andy Griffith Show, Peyton Place, and Magnum P.I. And Byron Morrow appears as Admiral Westervelt. Morrow had appeared previously in season 2's Amok Time as Admiral Comac, a totally different admiral, although he looks exactly the same. He was also an incredibly prolific actor with 239 credits over his five-decade career, and he appeared on shows such as Perry Mason, Peter Gunn, Mannix, and Get Smart. And I should mention, of course, that James Doohan provides the voice of the Oracle in this episode.
The very stentorian, you know.
Yes.
You must be punished, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And like I said, we actually, you know, you don't see a lot of our regular cast because it's mostly all it's the McCoy episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although he does have a couple of nice scenes with, Nurse Chapel in the beginning, sort of bookending the thing.
Yes.
Nurse Chapel is understandably upset about the fact that McCoy is dying.
Yeah, I like the fact that was he just not going to say anything just in a year on some away mission? He would just fall over dead from his disease.
I think duty would have called eventually, but he's clearly trying to downplay it, and he doesn't, you know.
Yeah, doctors make the worst patients.
Yeah, you know, he doesn't get too. There's a nice moment in terms of a character moment when they're trapped on the planet and McCoy is not in good shape. Kirk takes it upon himself to violate HIPAA regulations and yes. tell Spock, oh, you should probably know that McCoy is not at his best here, you know?
Yeah.
And to McCoy's credit, when McCoy, who's unconscious at the time, kind of comes out and it kind of comes out that, you know, Spock knows, he's like, okay, right, you know, fine. He's actually not too cantankerous about it. He's like, okay, under the circumstances, you know.
Yeah.
This is probably, you can tell he would just as soon people not know about it. I think it's not because he's trying to do his business. He just doesn't want to deal. He's a crusty old guy. He doesn't want everybody holding his hands. Giving him pitying looks and feeling sorry for himself. And so, you know, there's actually another nice moment, because this is a good McCoy episode, where when they're getting ready to beam down to the planet, you know, McCoy shows up for the landing party and Kirk, who has just found out that McCoy is dying, is like, hey, you know, Bones, you know, you don't have to come along. And, you know, I know Bones does not want to be treated like kid's blood with kid's gloves just because he's sick.
And yeah. Yeah.
Kirk is kind of like, you up to this? And I want to come along. Oh, okay, fine. And, fine. You know, at that point, you know, McCoy's illness is not obvious. He does not appear to be a liability. So Kirk's Kirk's first instinct is to baby him and put him out the pasture, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, it is interesting. I'd forgotten that there's a whole alternate universe here that Kirk had already put in for a replacement.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I'm not criticizing Kirk, but, oh, so there's an alternate universe out there. Oh, who was going to, suppose, you know, McCoy did die. Who were they going to send to replace him, you know?
Yeah, it's like the replacement captain for Discovery at the end of season one, like he's still sitting.
We may never know who that replacement captain was.
Yeah.
Apparently there is at least, I was doing some research last night, there is at least one Star Trek novel set in the Mirror Universe, where apparently in the Mirror Universe, McCoy killed over and Mirror McCoy killed over and died.
Yeah, I think that's David Mack's novel.
And was replaced by Dr. Mbenga.
Which yeah, makes right.
Sense, you know.
Yeah, I think that's Sorrows of Empire by Mac. Yeah. There's so much going on in this episode, but I guess we should talk about maybe the main conceit, and that's the idea of Yonata as a generational ship. And I love generation ship stories, and I'm not exactly sure why, but I think it's because you hardly ever have a generation ship story where something doesn't go wrong somehow and the story becomes something else. And since space stories began, we've been mashing together genres, putting other genres in space, cowboys in space, fantasy in space. And when you have people on a generation ship and things go sideways, you can play out any one of those genres in space and you've got a cool mashup. I mean, imagine how boring a generational ship story would be if nothing went wrong, like it just got to its destination fine.
See, I've seen people question why the creators, which are the original architects of the ship, are referred to, didn't want their descendants to know they were on a ship, and why the whole, you know, quasi-religion around the Oracle.
Right.
And the only rationalization I could come up with this morning as I was having breakfast was that, okay, 10,000 years is a long time. Lots of things can go wrong. They didn't want mutinies or insurrections or, you know.
Yeah.
Politics or civil wars. So, okay, they were there. So fine. The creators were control freaks. You got this. This is the last hope of their civilization, of their species. What could go wrong over the course of 10,000 years? Let's maintain an iron grip on this thing. We will, you know, create this whole religion about you do not question the Oracle. You stick to the plan, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe they thought that people would freak out. They did some psychological testing back on, you know, wherever on Fabrini homeworld.
Yeah,
they're the Fabrini. It's indicated that if people find out they're trapped for generations on a spaceship,
yeah.
they'll freak out, they'll go insane, there'll be mass neurosis, whatever. So fine, our psychologists tell us that if you want to maintain a functional civilization for 10,000 years.
Right, right.
You know, this is the society we need. We need stability. We don't want revolutions and mutinies and religions and politics. You know, you worship the Oracle. The Oracle keeps you on track.
Yeah.
You keep the ship working, and nothing is allowed to change for 10,000 years.
Yeah, so. I'm glad to hear you say that. I was thinking the exact same thing, because the idea behind a generational ship is that, you know, the crew will train their progeny to keep it going. But if any link in that chain is lost or apathy sets in, you know, you could lose the whole mission. But I like that idea that there's a lot of social engineering involved, where the original builders are like, no, we'll just let automation and religious indoctrination take care of it for us. You know, we'll give them this idea that they have a destiny, and keep your hands off the control. Don't touch anything. And you'll...
That's basically, yeah.
Yeah, you'll get there eventually. Now, on the other side, you've got the problem of how do we deprogram this race, like, to have their own destiny once they reach the planet. And that's something that's explored in Chris Bennett's novel Ex Machina, which is a follow-up to this episode, where the society without the control of the overseer has broken down into these factions, and there's people that, like, kind of want to go back in and, you know, plug us back in. We want the cult still.
Well, the time frame, actually, of the episode, they made some interesting choices of the time frame, is that for those who have not seen it, the ship is about 393 days away from reaching its destination.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that we're coming in at the very tail end of the voyage here, that after 10,000 years, they're only about 300, they're only about a year away from reaching their destination.
Right.
Which is, I wonder why they chose that. There's also the fact that even though we actually have this ticking clock of, oh my God, the asteroid is going to slam into this planet, that's 393 days away. So as ticking clocks go, there's not a whole lot of urgency.
Right.
And I found it very interesting that you had this, oh my God, you know, it's going to, you know, slam into another planet. But it's not a case of we have only 48 hours to stop this, you know, ship smashing into another planet.
Right.
We have 393 days.
Yeah, to figure it out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Although I laugh, where I'm milking this for humor here, but in some ways that's actually more believable, realistic in terms of the whole vast reaches of space. It would be quite a coincidence if something came out of nowhere and there's 48 Starfleet didn't notice that there was an asteroid about to slam into this, inhabited planet.
Yeah.
Until 48 hours ahead of time. It's a year out in deep space. That's okay.
Sure.
It would be an awful big coincidence for the Enterprise to just be tootling along and bump into it.
Yeah.
48 hours before it's about to,
Yeah, that's true. There's already a lot of coincidence in the episode.
On the other hand, it is weird that you've got this whole sort of ticking clock, instead of, oh my God, we need to stop the asteroid from smashing into the planet.
Yeah.
But we don't, as opposed to just regular, thriller writing, TV writing, we don't have a countdown where, 17 seconds to, collision,
yeah,
14, and where, they're sweating blood and Spock is managing, to get the engines working again.
No.
If you look at Paradise Syndrome, it comes down pretty down to the wire,
Yeah. And when they find the controls, they're like, oh, this is just like the Enterprise. So there's not really even any tension there. Plus you've got the fact that McCoy has this disease and he will expire in around a year, which is a weird lineup with, the impact time for Derek Five.
Everything is a year away.
Yeah.
It's like they've got all these sort of tension generators, but at the same time, it's
pull
like,
up, they're not connected.
Oh my God, McCoy is dying.
Yeah.
A year or so. So it's not like say Requiem for Methuselah, where they've got 72 hours to get the cure to the Rigelian fever, and everybody on board is going to die, or Miri or any number,
And apparently the Federation has made an extensive archaeological dig on Fabrini, the homeworld. So Spock could basically read Fabrini, but nowhere in their archaeological research did it say anything about launching a generational ship in any direction. So there's a lot of dots that aren't exactly connected in the episode.
Now, to be clear, I don't think that, the Fabrini homeworld was wiped out by a supernova.
Oh, that's true. But then...
So it's not like, I guess the Fabrini must have colonized space enough that there's minor relics out there enough for the Federation to be vaguely aware of, we found some inscriptions in Linear B Fabrini.
Okay.
The fact that their entire civilization, their home planet was destroyed by a supernova. So there probably haven't been, a whole lot of archaeological digs there.
Yeah.
And they're probably, we don't know how. I guess we have to assume that the Fabrini traveled beyond their home world to some degree, or there's some records. Or actually, I'm just extrapolating here. I'm talking.
Yeah, I mean, you're meeting them more than halfway.
It's possible that all their information about the Fabrini is secondhand.
That's true.
That there's no action. That another galactic civilization, perhaps another dead galactic civilization. And the Star Trek universe, particularly TOS, is littered with dead galactic civilizations.
Yeah.
Had records of, we dealt with the Fabrini, so all records of the Fabrini were, the library on, something prime had some ancient historians who mentioned a ancient trip to Fabrini or had records from Fabrini, even though the primary sources have all been wiped out,
Yeah.
We know of them secondhand because of, their contemporaries or historians from the so-and-so empire, collected relics from Fabrini before they died,
There is, I wonder, there is, as you mentioned, mention of several dead or sort of passed away civilizations in Star Trek. But every other civilization seems to be pretty much technologically equal. And I wonder about that as sort of like a world-building note. I mean, obviously it means that, other hostile races can threaten Federation vessels. Also, we don't have to stoop down too much to or step up too much to meet or discuss things with other races. But I wonder about if that's it's a side effect of the Prime Directive. Is it a bug or a feature that all the races seem to be about equal technologically? Because we can't really deal, because of the Prime Directive, we can't really deal with races that are too far below the Federation in terms of technological advance.
Although that was looser in Kirk's time, Notice that Kirk's pretty free about, your planet, it's a spaceship,
Yeah, right. They mentioned very briefly the Prime Directive and then go right through that.
Yeah, to be fair, yes, Spock brings up, there is lip service to, gee, should we interfere with their society here? Kirkman points out their society is about to smash into another planet. Oh, okay, yeah. So, okay.
Yeah, I suppose.
again, the sort of conceit that everybody seems to be, the Romulans, the Klingons, the Cardassians, are all sort of roughly contemporaneous in terms of technology and weapons, just to, I suppose, ideally, there should be civilizations out there that are so above us that they simply leave us alone and are unengaged.
Sure.
You know, and you get a little bit of that with the Organians, although they've evolved to a higher stage of being.
Yeah.
You know, there may well be, you know, so maybe there's planets. Oh, we don't go there because, you know, the monoliths have told us attempt no landing here.
Sure,
you know.
Sure. Yeah.
that's something that hasn't been super explored. I'm sure there must be a novel somewhere.
Yeah.
Or a comic book somewhere that the cultures, oh, well, there's the so-and-so empire, but they want nothing to do with us lowly primitives because of their version of the prime directive, you know.
Sure.
I think, remember that, I think there is at least one Enterprise episode, you know, Jonathan Archer Enterprise, where they run into Enterprise actually got some tension out of the fact that the Vulcans were not in a big hurry to share their technology with the humans.
Right, right.
And then there's an Enterprise episode where Archer finds himself dealing with an alien race that would like their technology, and he runs into the sort of proto prime directive, actually. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm finally actually kind of sort of understanding the Vulcans, because he's been sort of, you know,
right,
had an attitude about the Vulcans not sharing their warp drive technology. Oh, they beat this race, and oh, they're really not ready for this, are they?
Yeah.
Okay, I kind of see where the Vulcans are coming from now.
Yeah, right.
Now, somehow,
right.
Like I said, the human race caught up really, really fast, you know. But,
yeah, right, right.
And sadly, apparently, like I said, in the vast reaches of deep time, you have apparently a lot of empires have risen and fallen and, you know, gone their own way. I guess, you know, they clear out to make room for new ones, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
You've got, like I said, Return to Tomorrow, and you've got even Turnabout Intruder, where they find the body switching gag gizmo on an ancient civilizations, and, you know, what are little girls made of? I could be sitting here rattling off the long dead civilizations forever, you know.
Sure.
All of which comes from, to a certain degree, you know, Forbidden Planet, you know, which was one of the major.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, the lost civilizations of the Krell and all that.
Generational stories get used a couple times more in other Trek series, but this is probably the best example, I think, of a Trek crew really getting in there and being on a generational ship. And it's been explored a lot in other bits of sci-fi. Authors Olaf Stapledon, Robert Heinlein have written stories. Even Harlan Ellison has written a generational ship story in Phoenix Without Ashes. And that means I get to play my favorite game on this show, which I don't get to play very often. Has the guest heard of the 1973 Canadian television series The Star Lost?
I know of it. I know of its reputation.
Sure. Okay, good.
I know that was Ben Bova who wrote a novel parodying it.
Yes.
And I believe it was Ed Bryant. Here, I'm going to show off my trivia here.
Okay.
I believe that, in fact, there was a novel that Harlan Ellison's original script got turned into a novel in collaboration with the late Ed Bryant.
Right.
But yeah, I know of Star Lost. I know it was ambitious. I know the myth that it was an ambitious idea that sabotaged by a painfully low budget, you know,
yeah, right.
Did not live up to it. That did not live up to its potential, to say the least. But again, I've never actually seen it. I know the history, I know the backstory, I know the spin-offs, you know. Star-Crossed, I believe, was the parody Ben Bova did, which was a Romana Clef about the behind-the-scenes confusion on that TV show.
Well, you win. You're the only guest, and I've spoken to a lot of people in the sci-fi world. You're the only person who's ever really heard of it or has any functional knowledge of it.
I remember it being talked about in Starlog magazines.
Yeah.
And like I said, I knew Ed Bryant back in the day. So he collaborated with Harlan on the novelization, you know, so.
For the things that I mentioned before, like the juice that you can get out of a generational ship story, it's, I mean, Harlan was a brilliant author, obviously, but it really does milk that for all it's worth because, you know, their ship has all these different kind of compartments or areas. And so you can go to the medieval planet, you know, or section one day, and then you can go to the cult section the other day. And the episode, the series begins with an episode where they're on like an Amish farmland sort of habitat. And so Sterling Hayden is like the fire and brimstone preacher that's trying to keep everybody from exploring the rest of the ship. And there's just a lot of potential there. But of course, you know, as it's created by Cordwainer Bird, we know that Harlan Ellison was not satisfied with what came out.
So I take it you've actually seen it.
Yeah, I actually have. There's a DVD like version of it that you can get. And so I haven't actually watched the entire thing, but I do find it a fascinating failure.
The world is full of those. Okay, you know.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And sometimes, like I said, they can be really fascinating. You know, I'll get myself in trouble here. I consider the first David Lynch Dune movie to be a absolutely fascinating failure.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know. Yeah.
And to give the Star Trek episode credit, I think it is the first time Trek did the generation ship. I mean, some of the stuff How the World is Hollow, you know, has been done before. The insane computer god ruling over the people who have forgotten it's a computer was a well-established, you know, Trek cliche by this point. But the generation thing ship was new. And I remember I, as a kid, found the idea very sort of evocative and mind-blowing. And, you know, the world is hollow. It's almost a shame we didn't see the scene of the old man climbing the mountains. And I could visualize, you know, clink, 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 you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no sky, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a couple episodes where aliens have, you know, there's aliens from the Andromeda galaxy, or there's the idea that people have come from a very long distance. But I think it's the first time that Earth-like beings, which, by the way, I guess the Fabrini are just human. Like, nope, that's never explored. Like, they're not blue.
I think this is a Star Trek, again, especially a TOS thing. If they did the episode in later eras, they would have some funny bumps in their forehead.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah.
It is weird that in the Star Trek, that in the TOS universe, you have, it's sometimes actually kind of blurry as to, okay, are these people, you know, colonists, a long distance Earth colony? Is it a case where they've been displaced? Like, you know, in Paradise Syndrome, obviously they are some, you know, Native Americans who were transplanted by aliens.
Right.
Or are you just dealing with, you know, and this was a conceit of any number of 50s science fiction, you know, because of, you know, also to practical reasons. No, these are the aliens and they were born on Delta Gamma 5 and they just happen to look like, you know, American guest actors or, you know, British character actors with imposing accents, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be actually kind of blurry here. I remember it's like the character of Number One. It was, is she human? Is she not? There was some prior to, you know, we're going to learn a whole lot of new stuff in Strange New Worlds, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But there was sort of this tradition that she was not from Earth, but was her planet, I can't remember the name of the species she supposedly, the planet she supposedly came from. But, okay, is she descended from Earth? Was this an Earth colony? Or is this just one of any number of races where they just land on the planet and, they just happen to have two arms, two legs, two eyes, and, you know, look like, and don't have purple skin or, And there are episodes where clearly just by context, no, this isn't an ancient Earth colony. This isn't even an ancient forgotten Earth colony. It just so happens that, you know, the people on Return of the Archons are pretty damn humanoid, you know.
Right, yeah.
Humanoids and humans, and there's just, you know, there are just, you know, convergent evolution, whatever. I mean, the people on Miri's planet, again, I don't believe are supposed to be.
No, and the continents are literally Earth-shaped.
I think there is a Star Trek novel, I think Chris Bennett wrote it, where he later tried to explain that they were from a parallel universe or something.
Okay, but yeah, yeah.
Miri's another one, what you were talking about, where they throw stuff at you and just sort of, this planet is a perfect duplication of 20th century Earth, and it's never really explained.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, there's Floyd's barbershop. Yeah.
Yeah. Why? Oh, but never mind. There's a zombie plague. Okay, let's, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, there's lots of, again, I think even, you know, Conscience of the King, it's unclear whether that planet where Anton Caridian and Leonard Caridian came from. Was that a distant remote Earth colony, or was it just a planet, you know, of humanoids, you right. know, who look like us, you right. know?
And it would take those, if it was a colony that's, you know, 100 or so years old, it would take those ships a long time to get there. That was actually the subject of David Gerald's first pitch to TOS. He pitched a story called, and get ready for more confusion, Tomorrow Was Yesterday, which dealt with a slower-than-light spaceship colony ship that, you know, would take generations to get where it's going, and the Enterprise kind of catches up with it before it's even reached there. And of course, they didn't, you know, produce that idea, but that was his introduction to the franchise.
Well, if you think about it, even like something like, you know, That Which Survives, again, another ancient lost civilization.
Yeah.
As I recall, there's no explanation as to why they look like Lee Merriweather, you know.
Right.
They're an ancient long civilization. They are presumably not a forgotten Earth colony.
Yeah.
They later flirted with the idea, occasionally, indeed in Return to Tomorrow, flirt with the idea that maybe some of these ancient colonies may have populated Earth or Vulcan or something, but that's, it usually doesn't hold up to close examination since we know what the evolutionary record is on Earth, and we were not, in fact, descended from Kelvins or something.
No, and they go full panspermia in The Chase for TNG, of
course.
Right,
which is an attempt to sort of kind of explain why even Klingon Tromulans and why we all interbreed, which is, again, something that you don't want to pay too close attention
to. Yeah, don't worry about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really the thing you just, like I said, it's you know, we love Star Trek, it's great, but okay, Mr. Spock is impossible. But yeah. None of us would ever want to do without Mr. Spock.
Right.
You know, you think about the fact that explicitly, wait, iron-based blood, copper-based blood, their metabolisms aren't even the same, you know?
Out. Yeah.
the fact that, wait a minute, wait a minute, they're not even, you know, copper-based. They're and yet somehow we can crossbreed, you know?
This sure. Is,
I think it was Larry Niven who pointed out in his essay, famous essay about Lois Lane and Clark Kent,
right.
that genetically, DNA-wise, that, you know, Lois Lane has more DNA in common with an apple, you know,
right?
You know, or an elm tree than she should have with a Kryptonian, but you right. know, it's, she should be able to crossbreed with, you know, a lobster more than she could, you know, crossbreed with a Kryptonian. But never mind.
There's a lot of Kirk destroys a society stories in Star Trek, and I've heard this episode described as a criticism of religion, but the original series never really went after organized religion all that hard.
That's a matter of interpretation. One thing, I've actually done panels on Star Trek and religion, and one thing that is true is, in fact, that when you're talking of a franchise at this point, it's 50 plus years, that's been written by, you know, diverse hands over the course of 50 plus years,
sure.
trying to find a consistent position. Oh, well, is Star Trek pro-religion? Well, that kind of depends what episode you're looking at and who wrote it, and, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a certain skepticism towards, you know, religion. You know, there's an awful lot of plots where, indeed, the gods turn out to be, you know, aliens or imposters or computers, you know.
Sure.
Harlan Ellison once joked that Gene Roddenberry had two plots, God is a child, God is an alien, you know. You know.
Yeah.
That being said, I actually did a panel on Star Trek and religion with a clergyman some years ago. I can't remember which division, preacher, priest, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of like, you know, is Star Trek poor? And I actually ended up, you know, because it was the conceit of the device was I took the position that, oh, Star Trek was primarily secular and did not have a religious point of view. But this minister or priest or whoever he was actually could point at any number of episodes, and he was able to see, you know, religious themes, and he, you know, and could make a very good case that if you want to, you can find, you know, Christian themes, you can find religion, you can find positive depictions of religion in Star Trek as well. And, you know, again, if you kind of depends on what you're looking for.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
To be fair, you've got the, you know, Bread and Circuses episode where you've got the whole business about the children of the sun versus the children of the sun, you know.
Right.
Which, you know, Yura goes, oh my God, they're proto-Christians, you know.
Yeah, right.
And there's the line, even when they're, you know, taking down Apollo, Kirk has, to me, honestly, I thought it was kind of an odd line where he mentions, oh, you know, the one God is good enough for us.
Right.
Which, me of my evil secular self, I always found kind of stood out like a sore thumb a bit, because it's like the only time you see Kirk, you know, talking about, you know, expressing a religious sentiment, but it's there. And actually, now that I think of it, you have Dr. Daystrom arguing with,
right.
You know, oh, you know, murder is against the laws of God, you know, so,
yeah,
you know, it stands to reason that you've got some people in the Star Trek universe are more religious than others. And indeed, Balance of Terror. There's a chapel aboard the Enterprise.
There is a multi-faith chapel. Yes,
it's non-sectarian, but there's a chapel aboard the Enterprise. Yeah. So we assume they use it. Yeah, you know?
They do for the wedding. I always found that line in Adonais to be more subversive than it seems, and maybe this is just my interpretation. But you know, he is talking about how gods are a pain in the butt, you know. He's basically saying, like, you know, the one God that we have is enough. Like, our monotheism is enough for us to try to combat against in terms of, I suppose, sentiment and you know, anti-religious or anti-scientific thought. He's claiming monotheism for Earth culture, but he's saying, you know, that's enough to deal with. We don't need a guy in a toga as well.
Well, and like I said, Star Trek could be puckish about this. There's any number of episodes where, you know, they kind of, oh, they tease Kirk, tease Spock about the fact that he looks like the devil. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the apple is called the apple for a reason, and there's the way to Eden. And usually paradises and Edens, and TOS at least, tend to have a worm in the ointment. Generally, if you find a place that seems like, you know, paradise and Eden, and they often use analogies like that, there's almost always an evil spore. There's a, you know, a right. Mind warping spore or a, you know, insane computer god or something behind it.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. I have a whole rant on the subject about how modern Trek, there's a lot, Trek is supposed to be utopian and everything, and this new version of Trek isn't utopian enough. Yeah, I know what they're coming from, but TOS actually had kind of a slightly jaundiced view of utopias, honestly.
Yeah.
On the one hand, yes, it was said in a far future was much better than ours. We're told over and over again that back on Earth they've overcome. Yet, in generally, TOS was kind of a little leery of things that were a little too perfect. You know, see this side of paradise, you know. Remember, they found a place that seemed to be a little where people were a little too happy and peaceful. Again, there was something wrong
with it.
And Kirk would usually give a little speech about, well, you know, mankind wasn't meant for perfection. You know,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
You know, notice how they're all reassured at the end of this. Oh, hey, what, my God, those colonists! Why they're quarreling and a fist fight broke out today. Good for them. You know, okay, they're
not. Yeah, yeah.
And you know. This time we, and the apple again, it's, oh, this is a good thing. You know, man was not meant for paradise. We need to struggle and strive and all this stuff. And,
yeah, it can be pretty wild and woolly. Even when you find a shore leaf planet, you could get, you know, skewered by a jousting knight or dive bombed by a Stuka or something like that.
Generally, like I said, Trek is optimistic, but also it has its cynical side to it.
Oh, yeah.
If something is too good to be true, it usually is. And
yeah.
Indeed, if Kirk is looking forward to meeting some well-renowned, revered member of the Federation, chances are they have feet of clay.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You've got Dagger of the Mind, where the brilliant psychologist who has supposedly revolutionized, it's like, well, he's not so great. You know,
no, he's great.
Dr. Gill. Okay, never mind. you know, the Omega Glory and Captain, you know. And indeed, poor Dr. Daystrom, who clearly has his issues, even though he's one of the greatest ever, you know.
Sure.
Great men often turn out to have their flaws. And if something is too good to be true, you know.
Probably.
Gee, this planet seems so peaceful. Oh, it's because of the spores.
Right.
Because of the, and indeed, it must be said, Yanata seems to be a rather pleasant place. It is, for all that they've got the, you know, very, you know, thunder and brimstone computer god, you mostly see people walking around wearing pretty clothing. Just
sure,
sort of, you know.
Sure.
And even the Yanadans, once, okay, they, you know, once they kind of calm down a little bit about strangers in their midst, are kind of like, oh, hi, we're here in peace. Oh, cool, cool. Yeah, welcome. They treat Kirk and Spock as welcome guests until they start trying to, you know, poke around the
sure.
Oracle and mess with the controls, you know. The Yanadans seem kind of reasonably pleasant. I mean, they're kind of quick to sentence people to death. But when you see Kirk and Spock just wandering the halls, you see lots of pretty people and brightly colored floral clothing who all seem fairly amiable, you know.
Yeah. And we never really dive into what is on the surface, if anything. I mean, it's obviously constructed to look like a world, but is there life there? You know, they bring some food and some drinks in. I wonder if they get that from machines or if there is, you know, wildlife, something inside
they
the planet.
They mentioned, I get the impression there wasn't much going on the surface, which looked kind of desolate.
Yeah.
They mentioned that the Ferengi, their ancestors, that before the supernova destroyed them, you know, this was a slow process, they had slowly, their civilization had moved underground,
sure.
presumably because of the ultraviolet rays or intense, whatever. So that the Ferengi, Yanadans are kind of living like the ancient Ferengi did, underground in tunnels and things.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the Ferengi civilization, because their sun was getting bigger and bigger or whatever, had gradually moved underground. And I guess the idea is the Yanadans are also living largely underground in tunnels and things because that's how the...
Culturally, they've, yeah.
That's kind of how the Ferengi were living in their last generations and possibly last centuries. I think there's also, there would be a, if you want to keep the whole origins of the ship secret, you wouldn't want too many people running around because you're going to end up with more people like the old man who are going to go up there and plink, plink, plink,
right.
you know, touch the sky.
Yeah.
we're told that they have a convincing illusion. Natira, the priestess, mentions, but we have stars, I see the sun. Maybe that doesn't hold up to close examination, you know, over 10,000 years, you know, you'd have some bright guy going, have you noticed that the constellations don't move?
Yeah.
You
right.
know?
Yeah.
You don't think it's like a really just a big canopy, do you? You know? Again, they don't go into it deeply. The impression is that they do mentors. It's a throwaway line of dialogue about how the Yanadans live underground, much as the Ferengi did as their son was, you know, becoming increasingly, you know, hostile.
Whenever they finally reach their destination, then I suppose just start digging on whatever new planet it is. We have to live underground.
It's funny. It's a little unclear as where they're going. Presumably, it's not the planet they're going to smash into, you know.
Yeah. I think in Chris Bennett's novel, it's just another planet in the system that was their original
target.
There's
a little funny fuzziness, again, that they sort of, we're a year away from reaching our destination, and by coincidence, you're a year away from smashing into this other planet.
Yeah, right.
Are we meant to assume that the other planet is your destination, but for some reason, you're heading in for a crash landing instead of just going nicely into orbit around them or something,
they're,
you know.
Going for SETI Alpha 5 instead of SETI Alpha 6 or what have you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the fact that you've got, it's funny now, I had not thought about it. We mentioned that there's this weird year timeline where McCoy is going to die in a year. They're going to crash into the inhabited planet in a year. And they're supposed to reach the promised land in a year, you know.
Right, right, right. When she makes the offer too, that's what, you know, when he reveals to her, because she says, you know, you could rule with me. And he's like, yeah, hold on though. I've only got a year to live. So I wouldn't actually be, you know, ruling this new society with you when we reach the promised land.
And it should be noticed, one of the reasons why they break up at the end, it's not just McCoy going, oh, I'm not dying anymore. So long, honey. She has, you know, he actually invites her to come with him. And she's like, oh, no, I got responsibility for my people. You know, I'm the high priestess. I can't just run off with you. Especially since my people are facing some big things. You know, they're going to have to wrap their heads around the fact that our God is a computer. And, we're about a year away from reaching the promised land here. Now is not a good time for me as the divine ruler of our planet to suddenly go, you know, take off on a honeymoon on the Enterprise. You know?
Yeah.
there is sort of a, well, my duty calls, what they're going for is my duty calls me this way.
Yeah.
My duty calls me this way. And you know, gosh, we are ships, generation ships passing in the night, you know.
I think that I had read that Gene Roddenberry, in his novelization for the motion picture, had written that McCoy had gone back after he had left Starfleet after the end of the 5-year mission and studied the Fabrini medical data so that he could get some of those medical advancements out, like the cure to his own disease.
That would make sense. And yeah, it is sort of funny. Like I said, even though they break up at the end, the episode, you know, suggests that, you know, oh, down the road when, you know, the generation ship completes its voyage and everything's settled, maybe we can, you know, pick up where we left off or whatever, you
sure.
know, but.
Yeah.
But then the show got canceled, and who knows?
Well, it did get canceled. as we reach the end of the episode here, was there anything that you wanted to talk about still, anything left unsaid about For the World is Hollow?
Like I said, I think its major virtue, the strength of the episode, is it's a good McCoy episode,
yeah.
It's a good DeForest Kelly episode. And you can see that a lot of the other stuff, all the stuff we mentioned that was underdeveloped, I think is underdeveloped because to make room for the McCoy and the Tira storyline.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why, like I said, we don't get cutaways to, you know, Sulu and Scotty and Uhura, you know, sweating blood over on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And even like, you know, Kirk and McCoy, Spock kind of wander off on their side plots for a while, you know.
Sure.
And it's good. Like I said, we, you know, it's nice to see McCoy get, you know, DeForest Kelly is good. He handles him dying with some dignity. He makes the, hi, I'm going to drop everything and marry this woman I met 5 minutes ago, as plausible as it can be, and more so than any number of other Star Trek episodes where, you know, you have the love stories, you know, proceeding at warp drive.
Yeah.
You know, and the generations, you know, the positive, I don't think this is one of the greatest Star Treks in the world episodes where it's not Balance of Terror, it's not Doomsday Machine. But no, it's a good midless Star Trek episode, and it's got a nice showcase for Dr. McCoy and DeForest Kelly.
Yeah.
And the generation concept is very poetic and evocative, and I love the title, and I love the idea of the title, you know, clink, 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 you know.
Yeah.
My one regret is we don't see the clink, clink, clink scene, you know.
Yeah, if this was made today, we would definitely have a cut to a flashback where the old man is climbing and he clink, clink, clinks on the
And spot. I'm blanking on the actor's name, but he's actually great. He's got that one scene. He really sells it about how he walks up and he knows that the world is hollow.
Yeah.
And I touch the sky. And that's a great scene. And he actually sells that scene.
Yeah. Well, the last time you were on the show, we talked about your favorite captain, who was Kirk. And Kirk has a rep for talking computers to death, you know, rushing in where angels fear to tread. Can you think of an example, or have you ever written a story where Kirk, instead of tearing a civilization down, actually worked with the computer in charge or the powers that be to put the civilization in question back on the right path?
Okay, I'm going to be shamelessly self-promotional here.
Please do.
Here, and mention that in the new book, there is a scene near the end, without being too spoilery, where Kirk is racing against time to stop a supercomputer from self-destructing.
Interesting. Okay.
And I did that expressly for the fact that it just amused me to actually have a climax where you have a ticking clock.
Sure.
And Kirk is racing against time to stop the supercomputer from self-destructing.
Now that we've reached the end of the show, you'll receive a promotion to the rank of Lieutenant Junior Grade. And I think on the last show, you said that you'd like to work in the sciences department, you know, anything but a red shirt. As a social scientist, how easy do you think it'll be for a race like the Fabrini to adapt to the fact that they don't have to do what a computer tells them to anymore, or live underground if they don't want to?
I think realistically, that's going to be an adjustment. You've got, I mean, 10,000 years here. I mean, that's a long time. I mean, and indeed, if anything, you could argue that, well, they dialed it up. That did it really need to be 10,000 years? You know.
Yeah.
That's longer than the history of human civilization. Okay.
More or less. Yeah.
I mean, what the Egyptians were like 4,000 years ago? How long ago were the? I'm a doctor. I'm a writer, damn it, not a historian. But, you know, that's 10,000 years. We're talking, what, ancient Sumeria or something?
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
Human civilization has gone through a lot of changes since then.
Yeah.
You know?
Presumably in their owner's manual, a.k.a., you know, their holy text, there's a section near the end that tells them, like, what to do now. But that would be a tough period of adjustment.
And to, like I said, Natira's defense, that's one of the reasons why she does not decide to follow her heart and run off with McCoy, because, well, you know, she's, if anything, like I said, you could almost argue if it was somewhere halfway through the 10,000 voyage, she's fine, I'll leave, we can be another priestess.
Sure.
Nothing's going to change on the ship for 10,000 years anyway.
This is a critical moment at this point in the
just
journey.
Just at her people's most greatest turning point, which just got more complicated because she just found out their god, you know, their religion just got blown to smithereens.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Indeed, one can make a question that indeed the book, I confess, I have not read Christopher Bennett's book yet. It's actually ambiguous at the end whether Natira is going to tell the rest of her people that, oh, by the way, our god is a computer. Because in fact, there isn't a scene where this is revealed. And in fact, it's not, the Oracle is not destroyed. They just kind of reprogram it a little bit, you know?
Sure.
So it seems to me if I was Natira, I wouldn't just decide that, you know, rip off the Band-Aid, go and announce to your entire civilization that, oh, by the way, our religion, bunch of vacuum tubes. Okay, you know.
Yep.
But the way the plot's set up at the end, you know, because there aren't a whole lot of extras, Natira's the only one who actually sees Kirk and Spock tinker with the machinery and open the control room. So it's actually left at her discretion as to how she's going to sort of, you know.
Sure.
One would think she needs to actually come clean sometime in the next 393 days, but before they suddenly arrive at their destination. Or maybe she just says, yay, the gods have brought us to our, they know they're going to another destination, you know.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So it's not a huge leap to say you have to leave the ship now, because we've reached the promised land.
Right, this is the day.
Whether you want to say that the Oracle brought you to the promised land, or the Oracle, who, by the way, is an ancient computer, brought us to the, you know. If you look at the episode, she's the only one at the end who has seen the truth, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether she's still cool for people wandering around with the instruments of obedience is a good question.
Right.
But, you know, maybe we ought to rethink that whole thing. But.
Yeah, we're excited about the new direction, but can we get rid of the pain implants, please? Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. So, and in defense of the Oracle, we should mention that 10,000 years is a long time. Apparently the Oracle system worked. It's got them across space for 10,000 years.
Right.
And it's got them within 393 days of reaching their destination. So, yay Oracle, you know.
Sure.
We don't know how many heretics and dissidents and mutinies the Oracle has put down over 10,000 years, you know. And how many skeptics have gone the way of the old man.
Yeah,
you know?
Or how many people they nuked on the way there, too.
Yeah, but oh, I forgot about the nuclear missile. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, did we not mention that? Geez, some of those lost dead civilizations we ran
all
into.
All is forgiven. You know? Yes.
Yeah. Hey, what happened to that? You know, well, we lost our ship. You know, 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, it looks like you may have crossed the paths of the Fabrini asteroid. Okay. Yeah.
Shot more than a few of these missiles.
Sadly, the Klingons discovered that one of their colonies was blown up by the Unadans.
Yeah.
You know, have declared eternal war on, you know, the Federation for sheltering
words
them.
With so, you. Well, thanks so much for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe. And if people want to continue the conversation, and they can at EISGpod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
I don't have a huge social media presence. I'm not on Twitter, but I hang out a lot at the Trek BBS website.
Oh, yeah.
And I hang out a lot on a lot of the Trek literary sites on Facebook. There's any number of pages and groups,
sure.
They call them groups, on, like, you know, Trek books and Trek literature and reading Star Trek. And I tend to hang out there and chat with other readers and writers and such. And in the glory days down the road, after we all have our vaccines,
yes,
I will be at, you know, going to bookstores and
sure.
Shore Leave in particular in Hunt Valley, Maryland is, you know, like home convention. In recent years, ZenkaiCon in Lancaster, Pennsylvania has been one of my, you know, bases of operations. So
yeah.
You know, I look forward to getting on the road again. Okay.
Yeah. If you see Greg, say hi. And your novel, A Contest of Principles, is available. And I'll have a link in the show notes where people can check that out.
And it's like I said, it's a very McCoy-centric novel.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we are signing off until the next mission, Hailing Frequencies Closed.